2013 marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, and some of the most iconic images from that political rally and other defining events of the 1960s were made by photographer Roland Sherman, who now lives in Orleans. East Ham documentary filmmaker Chris Suido has made a film about Sherman and his work called Eye on the 60s. It will air on many public television stations this summer, but will premiere in Dennis at the Cape Cinema on January 13th. Chris Suido and Roland Sherman join us in studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Chris, I want to start with you. Where did you get this idea to make a film about Roland, and what about his work inspired you?
The quick story, which Roland always likes the quick story. I literally just stumbled into a small gallery called Artworks, which is near the Lost Dog Pub near Town Cove at a kind of an obscure little place that doesn't get much foot traffic. And I walked in and no one was in there, so I had to, I could see these photographs by myself for about 5-10 minutes. Had time to absorb them. And as a little kid growing up in the 60s, I was always fascinated with the people. And it seemed what was nice about the photographs, or exceptional, was they were unified, they were clear, they were beautiful, they spoke, they had a spirit to them. And I wondered. Finally, the guy came upstairs who owns the place, Dave Hartford, and I said, "Who did this?" He said, "Roland Sherman." I said, "Possible to meet him?" He goes, "Maybe." It took about a month before I met Roland, and then we started to talk about doing this film.
Roland, what was your initial reaction? Somebody comes along and says, "Geez, I want to make a film about your work."
There's sort of a famous story about when I first met the Hartfords and Bob Korn, the guy who does our prints, that they said, "Boy, your stuff is great." And I said, "You know, I had been through my own portfolio so many times looking for new ways to look at it. And I keep saying, well, there's only 9 good ones." And Mary and Davey Hartford and Bob Korn and now Chris have convinced me that I was wrong. There's a whole lot more than 9 good ones. And I'm really, as anyone would be, pleased that it's some of my stuff has been rediscovered.
We'll get into some of that stuff that's been rediscovered in a little bit. But also, Chris, someone mentioned the soundtrack, because it sort of strikes you, even at the beginning of the film, you're talking about all of these events in the 60s and images, Judy Collins, the Beatles, Bob Dylan. But we're not hearing their music. Talk about that decision to make the soundtrack different.
Well, there's several reasons. I mean, one could point to an obvious one.
Buying the rights.
Buying the rights, yeah.
Which, would you like to help mortgage this building that we're in?
That expensive. Okay, got it.
Well, not only that, but then they give it to you for like a week.
Oh.
But, you know, if you're going to do something different, and I think you have one moment, the moment that film starts, what kind of a film, you have to grab people and sense there's an expectation. But yeah, you have a moment in which you can kind of alter that. Based on the setting, based how it appears, what is the first sound you hear? And so once they're comfortable with that and you develop a personal, this is a personal film. The music in it is personal. Mm-hmm. It's all original. And I do the music. I do most of it. There's another fellow in Boston named Daniel Burns, who's an exceptional singer-songwriter. He appears in it, as well as Monica Rizzio from Tripping Lily. Yeah, she adds her voice.
Voice of an angel. Yeah,
and one of the cuts. And, when you're filming it, you hear what you're filming. And I've been doing that part of, guitar work and all that since a teenager. So it just kind of naturally evolved into what it is.
Right. No, and you make it's a really good explanation, because it does work. It's because it's Roland's story, so it... The original
it's,
music.
It's not Bob Dylan's story. It's not the Beatles' story. It's Roland's story.
But since we are talking about music, you almost became a pop star there, or I should say teen idol, and we weren't pop stars at the time. 1959, we have a little clip of a song you do. This is your name back then, Billy Donahue. We'll get the backstory. Here's a little of Ooh, Darling. Roland, what's going through your mind right now?
I'll never let you
go. Well, the girl I wrote the song for, Cindy Chapin. She's, you know, I was in college. I said, come on, Cindy, let's go get a Coke or something. She says, ooh. So that's how the title of the song came along.
So,
but I was in Germany. I was in Austria as a junior year abroad, and I had my guitar with me, and the Germans, the Austrians and Germans were nuts about American rock and roll, and it was, and if you know the chords, you know, C, A minor, F, G7, strum, 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 sing, 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 and you know, I had a fan base in Austria way back in 1958, 59, and when I came back to the States after my junior year, I walked into the Brill Building where the, you know, Tin Pan Alley is. Mm-hmm. And while I was walking in, Jerry Moss and Marvin Kane and the co-ed record people were walking out, and they saw me, and they turned around and were going up to their office. And that that day I had a contract. Believe it or not,
it was on the basis of his looks.
yeah, I know. I was sort of teasing him beforehand. I was like, oh, he looks so dapper with that, you know, that pipe in his hand and his, you know, like movie star good looks, right?
Yeah. How about now?
You know, the other thing we talked about, the voice of Angel. This is the other Angel that's in the film, other than Monica. The surprising.
Yeah, the surprise. So,
well, the song went nowhere except Honolulu, because I think of the Hawaiian guitar. I think that made it made it number two in Honolulu. We're talking 1959 now, folks.
Yeah.
All right, and so, it made it number one in the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, I heard, but I'm not sure about that. And it never got higher than 38 or something. Right. In New York, in the hit parade.
So you were interested in photography young, though. So tell us about how you became attracted to taking photographs. You were a teenager, I think, about 14 or so, like that, when you first started going around with the camera. Were you a little younger than that?
That's interesting. I did take snaps on the family trips and things like that, and I thought they were swell. But everyone said yes and then started talking about something else. But in 1957, I had a summer job mixing chemistry at the Life magazine darkrooms, which was all gravity-fed to the darkrooms. You know, on the 33rd floor, it would gravity-fed to the 32nd floor. Hundreds of gallons of hypo and developer for Life magazine. And '57 is when I really started shooting pictures. I bought a real camera. I was meeting all the photographers at Life magazine, and I was fascinated by it.
Yeah. Well, and the film starts in a philosophical way, reminding us that our paths in life have an end, but a camera has the power to make things eternal, capturing a moment, a person, a feeling. Yet making a good picture is also an art as well as a science. So, but Roland, in the film, you mentioned seeing light emanating from your subjects, and it's a moment you know when to take the shot. Describe that moment. What is that for you?
It's tough to describe in words. I guess if I could describe it in words, I'd be a writer, but that's the whole point. When I shoot a picture of somebody, it seems as if, more often than not, that the subject says, that's really me. You've really caught the real me. I've never seen me seen that way. And I think this has happened so often that I sort of made it seem as if I could see light shining out of people. But and if so, that's, I guess that's my talent. But I am very happy with the portraits I've done, and so it seems are the people I photograph.
Roland just has an ability to be in the right place at the right time with the right mindset. And, you know, I think photographers are mysterious people, and they kind of, you don't know they're there half the time. And that's part of it. It's not as simple as taking a you know, just even with an iPhone and all that, you know, and especially back then when it really required a knowledge and an ability to, you know, because as Roland will say, there's only a handful of people back then that really knew how to work the dials.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, and maybe it's the same can be said today. I don't know.
Well, I think it's true of the good photographers anyway. And Roland, one of the things when you talk about that, seeing the light emanating, I remember a photographer friend I had many, many years ago, and I asked him, what it was he looked for in his subjects. And he said, I don't take pictures of people or things. I take pictures of light. And that was his sort of, I guess maybe there's a similarity in that.
I know that guy. What was his name?
I don't think you know
Philly
him.
Paulsman
no,
said
No, I know, but that was that not way. Him.
Some
no.
people take a picture of too much light.
Too much light sometimes, right. So like many individuals of your generation, you were inspired by John F. Kennedy's speech in 1961. Of course, it's asked not what you can do for your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. So you became the official Peace Corps photographer. Tell us how that happened.
You got to see the movie. All the stuff is in the movie.
I have seen the movie. I know.
You have?
I have. But our audience hasn't seen it yet. So,
well, like so many others, I was inspired by Kennedy. And I think in the same speech, he mentioned the Peace Corps. And, I was doing portraits of off-Broadway actors. And I had just started, really. But I went to D.C. and said, here I am, I want to be your photographer. And they said, no, we don't need photographers. We need doctors and teachers and lawyers and technicians and nurses. So well, let me hang around anyway. And they said, okay, don't get your hopes up. And then as if by magic, a person showed up. Her name was Her Majesty, Her Royal Highness Princess Beatrix of the Netherlands shows up. And she wants to get her picture with Shriver. And all the photographers had left before, and I was still there. And they said, where's that kid with the camera? Mm-hmm. And I was right there with the camera. And how could you miss? Princess Beatrix was beautiful, young, and vibrant princess. Sarge Shriver was one of the handsomest men in the planet. Anybody could have done it. I was just lucky enough to be there to do it.
As Chris, like you say, he's been in the right place at the right time, it seems, for a lot of the photos.
Sure was in that sense.
Through the Peace Corps, you formed a relationship with Sergeant and Eunice Shriver, and in the extension of the Kennedy family. At the time, they were the equivalent of American royalty. So describe what that was like for you. You went to, you were taking photos when Eunice Shriver first had some, I guess the beginnings of the Special Olympics, and did their family portraits for holiday cards and things like that.
I did Bobby's Christmas cards for a couple of years. I got to hand this one to Chris because he discovered the fact that I worked with Eunice on the Special Olympics, which really wasn't called the Special Olympics in those days. It was just something that Eunice was doing to help out disadvantaged young people. And she asked me to come and document it, and I said, sure. And then I forgot about it for 50 years. But when Chris saw my portfolio and went through all this stuff, he realized that it was the opening weeks of Eunice Shriver's Special Olympics. So I would, I said, gosh, you're right. That's what it was.
Well, I did a little research on it and, learned that, the actual name of Special Olympics, I think, occurs in 1968 at Soldier Field in Chicago. And but Eunice had been developing this concept on her, on her own, and another woman who I forget the name of was developing that. But what Roland took was the very first moment that they decided to take these kids that are, developmentally challenged, and have them experience a fun day in the country, potato sack races, the guitar. Even Roland was even playing the guitar to him, going under the. The horizontal bar, the conga line, right. Or whatever, and swimming in the pool. And there was a shots of Eunice in a pool with this young black girl that are heartbreaking and beautiful.
Powerful, yeah.
Yeah, and I still see that photo. I'm seeing it right now as he speaks.
Yeah.
And, he said, I was only there for a few hours, but it is enough to get a couple of roles and enough certainly to build a sequence. And I think this is a big surprise to come up with this. This is a real gem.
Yeah, absolutely.
This segment.
Well, and it speaks to that talent again, Roland, that you have of sort of capturing the emotion of the moment. A lot of like you say, a lot of photographers do the portraits where you're sitting there and you have the smile and it's what you might expect. A lot of your photographs are not that. They're sort of candid shots, and you really kind of like that picture of Eunice Shriver in the pool with the little girl. You see the emotion between them. It's really kind of magical.
Is it?
I think so.
Well, I think that's what I was trying to tell you. What I see when there's a aura about it, it makes me want to make that image. Mm-hmm. And I did. But I still think the credit goes to Chris for finding this stuff. I sort of remember doing it, but it was deep, deep, deep in my files. It wasn't ever going to see the light of day unless Chris had discovered it.
But, you know, there is something that what Roland and I do share. I mean, I'm behind the camera. I see, you know, a rectangle. He certainly sees the aspect ratio of 35 millimeter. And when you put your eyeball in there and you're looking around and, you know, you're there to do a job. And, you know, you bring your own philosophy to it. These things seem to happen when you're... It's not like you're deciding that they should happen, but you're just what he calls F8 and be there. Stick it in the middle of the dial and be there. And be there also means to have your physical feet and body there, but it's also to have your mind there.
Right. Yeah. We're talking with Chris Suido. He's a filmmaker, and Roland Sherman, photographer. We're talking about Chris's documentary, Eyes on the 60s. A defining event of the 1960s was the March on Washington in August of 1963, and 2013, as we mentioned, marks the 50th anniversary. This was one of the largest political marches in U.S. history, and when Martin Luther King Jr. made his famous I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. But before we talk about your photographs from the March on Washington, I'm going to play a little clip from the film. The first voice we hear is Richard Stolle from Life magazine, and then we hear Roland, you about covering the march.
When we find a journalist like Roland Sherman, for example, who takes what he does with extreme seriousness, when he goes out to cover a story, he knows what he's trying to do, he knows what the story is, he goes out and he gets the story from beginning to end. He is a perfect example of the kind of journalism and journalist that we don't have enough of today.
I just covered it the way I thought an event like this should be covered, so that anyone who wasn't there could see the breadth of it, could see the close-ups of it. To get a handle on the majesty and the importance of it, I just photographed it all in my way, and it turned out as well as it did.
Roland, what are your thoughts now, thinking back and looking at those photos now, as I know you haven't seen the whole film, but you've seen pieces of it?
Well, first of all, the comment from Dick Stolle is terrifically gracious, because the march was in 63, and I didn't start shooting pictures for Life until 66, 67, when I did a lot for him. But I didn't really start shooting for him for 3 or 4 years after the march. And let's see, at the march, I was pretty young. It was really early in my freelance career, and I worked as hard as hell as I did, as I do every assignment, really. And I knew, I guess I knew after being there and being surrounded by the breadth of it, I realized that this is, you know, this is an amazing event. I just better keep shooting.
Yeah.
And I did.
So there's a lot of photos, Chris, in front of it. How do you choose which ones to put in the film?
Well, that was one of the bigger thrills of the job. You know, when you hear about going, you know, going to the National Archives, you know, you're going to, you know, it's that's where the Kennedy film is. It's fascinating to... You know, he had not really looked at these since the day he handed them over, if he had even had a chance to look at what he did. And I could be wrong. There could be 40 rolls, 70 rolls. But it's interesting to follow his flight path that day and to sit with him and say, oh, yeah, there's Mary Travers. There's one coming up here. Oh, yeah, there's a cute girl coming up in this one. And, oh, yeah, that and you know, every one of these images... it could be a poster. It's when you're at the top of your game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and but to say which one are you going to get? Which one? And so what we did is we weren't like thieves down there, but we kept scanning every one. Do this one, do this one, that one. Trying to beat the clock as the guy's got to go on vacation the next day. And we can't, you know, it's just, you just go for it. You grab what you can, and you know, you have a sense of, I was able to see some of them beforehand. So I went in there with a plan.
So, yeah. So you had, to sort of tell the story through the day, through his eyes as much as you could.
Yeah, I contend it's one of the two greatest days in mm-hmm. American history in my lifetime. The other one being the moon landing, right. where it's a spiritual thing.
Right. I'm wondering also.
Just go back? It's true that I didn't see those pictures from the day I shot them, because they went straight to USIA, and then USIA disbanded, and they got their picture file moved to the National Archives. But I did see a German movie, and a boy and a girl are walking through this room, and in this room in Germany was a poster of the picture that I made of Bob Dylan and Joan Baez singing at the March on Washington. And, you know, I had no handle on whatever happened to all those pictures, but they got published worldwide, and, you know, they're in the Library of Congress. And I was wondering, how come I'm not seeing any of this? You know, like, right. I shot these pictures, and they've been taken away. And now they're back. You know, it's really nice.
Tragically, the 1960s also defined the losses of three heroes of the era, John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and Martin Luther King Jr. You covered John Kennedy while he was president, but in the film we note that after the assassination, you stopped taking pictures for a while. We also don't see any pictures of the immediate aftermath of Bobby Kennedy's assassination or Martin Luther King Jr. What was going on there? And you followed Bobby Kennedy on the campaign, and before the program we were talking about, these are pictures that life, you know, once he was assassinated, they didn't want to use now because that wasn't the story.
Well, there was no point to him. A story about a man running for president when he's no longer alive. It was a terrific essay that he did on Bobby. Had he lived and had he been, I'm sure he would have won the presidency. It would have been a tremendous essay. But, you know, when Martin Luther King and Bobby and Jack all got killed, it really took the wind out of the sails, to use a terrible expression, a terrible cliche. But the, you know, the summer of love and the whole 60s generation sort of became deflated and segued into unhappiness. Mm-hmm. And what did it take to get it back out of it? Woodstock, the Beatles, I mean, music helped out. Mm-hmm. I guess.
I love the story of the Bob Dylan shot you got that they used for the cover of the album that he won the Grammy with. You just kind of walk back. You did this with the Beatles, too. You just kind of get up. You walk backstage. You don't have any press pass. You've got a couple of cameras, and you just somehow manage to get into the place you want to be without any trouble.
Well, they don't want you to do it, but if at the time of the Dylan thing, I was shooting pictures for Life all the time. My credits were all over the country, and I was pretty hot stuff. So it didn't take much for me to BS my way behind the
Beatles, though. That was a different story.
That was totally different. That was, nobody knew what they had. The Beatles themselves were just starting out.
Yeah. You can thank his sister for that, for getting him into that one.
Yeah, Betsy was assisting another photographer that day. A British photographer.
And it was the day after they were on Ed Sullivan, their first concert in Washington College.
And the security were two cops, one on one side of the stage, one on the other. There was no...
Who were probably dancing to it.
Right. Well, and speaking of Bob Dylan, you had some... you photographed Bob Dylan during the weekend that he went from zero to hero, so to speak. That was the Newport Folk Festival in 1963. He was unknown at the time. And the photos that we have seen in the beginning, Bob Dylan's got like maybe 50 people there. And then when Joan Baez joins him, you know, the crowd gets bigger. This guy, what attracted you to him? He wasn't well known at the time.
Well, I went to Newport because Peter, Paul, and Mary were there, and I was crazy about Mary. I wanted to see her in person. I had seen her in person before, and I still was in love with her, and I had to see her again. And it was at the tennis courts before Bob Dylan's workshop. He was just standing around, and I was just standing around, and we were standing around next to each other. I did a couple of snaps of him and said, "Why don't I do a story about you?" And he said, "Yeah, that'll be cool." Of course, I was totally full of it because I didn't know who to send a picture story to in those days. I was just a kid myself. But then when Joni sat in with him, the crowd multiplied by a factor of eight, and it was the biggest crowd that he'd ever had. And by the end of the weekend, he was like, it went from that. It's in the movie, folks. Yeah.
There's a lot in the movie.
He went from zero to hero that very weekend.
I think probably one of my favorite photos, I want to get this in before we run out of time, and I told you this before we went on, we were talking about this, Roland, is I love the photo of Joni Mitchell and Judy Collins up in the treehouse.
Well, thanks a lot. I love that picture.
And so what inspired that? You saw the treehouse and just said, hey, why don't you guys get up in the treehouse?
Joni Mitchell was a songwriter who hadn't recorded yet. She wasn't the brilliant star that she is now, but she was a brilliant songwriter. And Judy had made a hit of Both Sides Now, and we went to visit her, and we hung around her cute little house in Topanga Canyon. I looked out the window, and there's a treehouse. So just to get another angle, I said, why don't you kids go up in the ladies? I don't know what I called them.
You gals.
Would you please go up in the treehouse? I'd make a picture of you up there. It'll be great. And they said, okay, and they did. And sure enough, they were like little singing sisters in that beautiful treehouse.
Yeah, beautiful photo.
And I would say, you know, that photograph really, you know, those are two of my heroes. I think the decision to actually really want to go ahead and do this was based on that photograph.
Really?
I was turned on to it. Well, because it represents such a positive thing and a big thrill in this movie. And Judy Collins is in her film, and mm-hmm. she gave a great interview. And I really wanted to ask her, what was it like to, you know, be up there? And, you know, when you look back at it, and was very, you know, gracious and says, well, I think it's maybe the best photograph anybody's ever taken of me. And it is a very joyous photo.
Right, it is. And there's a lot of great photos that, in a lot of other instances, we aren't going to have time to get into to talk about here.
It is about music getting us out of the doldrums that we were into with the demise of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King.
And now you talk about light in the film, but you also talk about we see this scene in the film where Roland's walking around this deck thing and just kind of taking these photos of what seems like randomness. And then you put it all together and it's just, it's brilliant. So we get to see a little bit of how your work has evolved and changed over the years. And I'm sure a lot of folks are going to be interested in seeing this. The film is Eye on the 60s. It premieres Sunday, January 13th at the Cape Cinema in Dennis. Roland Sherman and Chris Suito, thanks for joining us.
Buy the tickets online because they are going fast.
Thanks, Roland.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.